Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
But God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
C.S. Lewis wrote, "Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you he is a nobody. Probably all that you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. He will not be thinking of humility. He will not be thinking of himself at all."
Welcome to Q Ideas. I'm Gabe Lyons, and today we're hearing from somebody who currently would be seen as one of the great public intellectuals of our time. His name is David Brooks. He's a columnist for the New York Times and has been since 2003, but every few days is writing a column that really challenges public thought, challenges morality. He really writes from a perspective of how should morality shape our economics, our politics, a virtue in society, and just an incredible thinker, somebody that's respected broadly from people who have faith to no faith at all. He's somebody who's been on his own faith journey, and he's actually been very transparent about that in the last couple of years of his own rediscovery of Christian morals and Christian faith and understanding some of the rootedness of Augustine and so many others and where that came from. Because I think he's learning and understands that, look, if we don't have something that transcends just how we're feeling or what's relative to our current situation, something more deeply rooted, then how do we really know what's good and wrong and evil and what is right? And so as we move into this talk, you're going to get to hear 18 minutes from somebody who I just believe is quite brilliant. And I think you're going to see that because part of this talk is challenging our current age. And he's really stepping into this age of celebrity, into this age of individualism, into this moment where many of us are challenged every day to just think about ourselves, right? Think about what have we accomplished and how many people might be following us on Twitter or on any social media channels, or how are the ways in which we're enlivening our own life and where our own experience is great. And it's just all about us. Well, David steps into that and says, look, this is not part of virtue. This is not actually the way forward. This is not how you develop maturity and wisdom and all of the attributes that any human being actually needs to possess in order to have a truly fulfilling life and to live the quote unquote good life. And so you're going to hear from his perspective how we might think better about humility. What does it mean for us as Christian leaders, as those who are trying to in a culture right now where few people have time to think and listen and just pause and reflect? How are we going to be countercultural in that space? And so as we begin this, I just want you to take a moment, just kind of sit back, put the headphones on, or find a space where you can go up to about 30,000 feet and you can start to appreciate a little bit of the history of how we think about this virtue, how we think about what it means to step out of the hustle and the busyness and the effectiveness and the productivity of your current day-to-day life so that you can consider for a moment, who is the kind of person you're becoming? Because ultimately, who we are becoming is going to shape the way in which we have any real influence in the world. So let's listen in to David Brooks on humility in the time of me.
So I was driving home Sunday night a few years ago, and on NPR on Sunday nights, they rebroadcast old radio shows. And I heard a show called Command Performance. And Command Performance was a variety show that went out to the troops in World War II. And it was had all the big stars on it, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. And the host is Bing Crosby. And the particular episode I happened to hear was broadcast live on VJ Day, 1945, just hours after the Japanese announced their surrender. So Bing Crosby gets out there, and he says, "We've just learned we've won this war. But I guess at this moment, we don't feel too proud. We just feel humble. We're just glad we got through it." And I was really struck by the tone of humility in that statement at that moment. But it was a tone that was replicated several times throughout the show. In the middle of the show, Burgess Meredith, a character actor who some of you may remember from Rocky, gets out there and he reads a passage from Ernie Pyle, the great war correspondent who had been killed a few weeks before. And Pyle had written, "We're winning this war because we have brave soldiers, because we have great allies, because we happen to have been blessed by material abundance. We didn't win it because we're special. We should just try to be modest and be worthy of the peace." Tremendously struck by that tone. Get home, turn on the football game. Quarterback throws a pass to a wide receiver. Wide receiver catches it and is tackled after a 2-yard gain. The defensive player does what all professional athletes do in moments of supreme personal accomplishment. He does a victory dance in honor of himself. And it occurred to me I had seen a bigger victory dance after a 2-yard gain than I just heard after winning World War II. And so this symbolized to me a shift in our culture, a shift from a culture of self-effacement that says I'm no better than anybody else, but nobody's better than me, to a culture of self-advancement that says I'm pretty special. And so in that culture of self-effacement, there were certain traits that I think were taught more commonly than are taught in American culture today. One trait is the idea that we have an internal struggle within ourselves. The man who was head of the European armies at that moment of command performance was Dwight Eisenhower. When Eisenhower was 3, he wanted to go out and go trick-or-treating. His mom wouldn't let him because he was 3. He had a ferocious temper, so he punched the tree in his front yard. And he punched it so much until his hands were bloodied and all the skin was worn off. His mom sent him to his room. He cried for an hour. His mom finally went up there to bind his wounds. And she said to him, something you'll recognize, "He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh the city." 76 years later, Eisenhower said that was the most important moment in his life. Because he said, "I realized I had things in myself that I was ashamed of, that I would have to fight. There was a struggle to fight the anger and rage that was in myself." That was one part of the ethos. The second part was a bias against self-preoccupation. The man who was head of all U.S. forces at that moment was George C. Marshall. My favorite Marshall story starts in 1943. He wanted to run Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion. Whoever ran that would be running the greatest military operation in human history, would go down in history. Churchill told him he was going to get that job. Stalin told him he would get that job. Franklin Roosevelt knew that if Marshall wanted the job, he had to give it to him because of Marshall's incredible stature. So he calls Marshall into the Oval Office in about 1943, and he says to Marshall, "Would you like to run the D-Day invasion, Operation Overlord?" And Marshall says, "My own personal feelings should have no bearing on your decision." And so Franklin Roosevelt asked him the question 4 separate times, "Do you want this job?" And each time Marshall refuses to bite, he says, "Do not think about me. What am I thinking is completely irrelevant to your decision." And Roosevelt wanted to keep Marshall close to the White House, not send him to London. So he took that opportunity to give the job to Eisenhower. And Marshall was crushed. He went home that day. It was the only day in the war. He went home unable to work. But it was his code: "I will not talk and think about myself." And humility is not low self-esteem, it's low self-preoccupation. And out of that code of low self-preoccupation, you get movie stars like Gary Cooper, Gregory Peck, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda. Some of you may have seen or heard the radio show or TV show Dragnet, Joe Friday, not thinking about himself. Even when I was covering politics, George H.W. Bush, when he was running for office, he was raised in a manner that said, "Do not talk about yourself." His campaign staff would beat the crap out of him and say, "You're running for president, you have to talk about yourself." So after 2 weeks of beating, he would finally talk about himself. His mom would call up and say, "George, you're talking about yourself." The third element that was common was a sense of vocation. The woman who was Secretary of Labor at that moment of command performance was Frances Perkins. Frances Perkins was having tea, a very highborn lady from Maine, having tea in Washington Square in New York. One day, about 1912, 13, somewhere around there, she hears a commotion. She rushes outside. She comes across a fire just off Washington Square. It's the famous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The 8th and 9th floors are on fire, And as at 9/11, people are jumping from the windows to escape the flames. 76 people jump to their death to escape the flames. She sees a guy lift a woman over the windowsill, hold her out, drop her down. Another woman, drop her down. Another woman, drop her down. Fourth woman, it's his sweetheart. They kiss. He drops her down. And then he himself leaps to his death. She sees this and decides to dedicate her life to the cause of worker safety. In realizing that cause, she has to make incredible personal sacrifices. She's a woman lobbying in the 1920s in Albany, New York. No one will take her seriously because she's a woman. But she discovers they'll take her seriously if she dresses like mom. So she's 28 years old, but she dresses as if she's 70. Gray frumpy outfits, pearl tri-corner hat. In order to get taken seriously, she suppresses her own attractiveness and sexuality to be taken seriously. One of a whole series of self-sacrifices for her vocation. And so that was the third thing that was common in that element. The fourth thing quickly was an element of seemliness. You may be running a large corporation and you may be worth $25 million, but you weren't going to ask for it because you simply had a deep commitment to social equality. Now we've shifted, and I want to be clear, I don't want to go back to the 1940s and 50s. None of us would be happy in that culture anymore. But in the transition away from that culture, we've lost, I think, a character formula. A character formula based on your own weakness, based on your own sin, based on the idea that you are a competition, you contain both an ethos of majesty and an ethos of humility. Based on the idea, a Jewish precept that a rabbi goes into the synagogue with two pieces of paper in his pocket. One piece of paper says the world was created for you. The other piece of paper that says you are nothing but dust and ashes. And both those statements are true. And it was a balance. That balance got eroded in the last 30, 40 years. And the shift happened for many reasons. In part, it happened because of psychologists. A guy named Carl Rogers took a look at his patients and he said, you know, the problem with my patients is not that they think they have too much pride and think too highly of themselves. The problem with my patients is they don't love themselves enough. We have to teach them self-love and self-esteem. And a lot of institutions, including corporations, schools, churches, synagogues, shifted away from warning against pride to preaching self-love and self-discovery and self-esteem. The civil rights movement and feminism happened. You had a lot of people who had been taught to have too low self-esteem. They needed to be boosted up. Workplaces changed. We're no longer mass factory workers. We have to brand ourselves and broadcast ourselves. Technology happened. Facebook and Twitter, more time expressing yourself, creating a distinct identity for yourself. So the shift happened. And this shift is measurable. In 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? In 1950, 12% of high school seniors said, yes, I'm a very important person. They asked the same question in 2005, and it wasn't 12%, it was 80%. So that's a shift in self-conception. If you look at math scores, we are now 36th in the world in math performance. But if you ask American students, are you really good at math? We are number one in the world in thinking we're really good at math. The lowest scores, by the way, are the South Koreans who think they're the worst at math. They are, in fact, the best at math. In 1962, there were zero articles on self-esteem in the education journals. By 1992, there were 2,500 a year. Psychologists give tests they call the narcissism test. They read people a bunch of statements and they say, does this apply to you? Statements are things like, I like to be the center of attention. I usually show off if I get the chance because I'm extraordinary. I find it easy to manipulate people. Somebody should write a biography about me. In the last two decades, there's been a 30% increase in the mean score of those narcissism tests. We are now an incredibly confident nation. 96% of college professors believe they have above average teaching skills. Time magazine asked Americans, are you in the top 1% of earners? 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. Paul Schumacher and Edward Russo gave tests to executives about their own industry, and then they asked them, how confident are you that you got the answers correct? In the advertising business, people were confident they got 90% of the answers correct. In fact, they got 60% of the answers wrong. People in the computer industry, is the most overconfident industry in America, by the way, thought they got 95% of the answers correct. In fact, they got 80% of them wrong. Overconfidence is a strongly gender-linked trait. Men drown at twice the rate as women because men have tremendous confidence in their ability to swim after they've been drinking. This has become a change in how college people and young people view fame. Fame has become a much higher priority. In 2006, 51% of 25-year-olds said being famous was an important life goal, twice as many as said being spiritual. 43% of middle school girls said they would prefer to be Justin Bieber's personal assistant than president of Harvard. Though to be fair, I asked the president of Harvard, and she would rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. College students were asked, would you rather receive praise and be famous or have sex? Twice as many would prefer to receive praise than have sex. And I tell them, I'm 50, I'm on TV a lot, I'm sort of famous, sex is better. But they don't listen.
You're listening to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, and we're right in the middle of an 18-minute talk by esteemed New York Times columnist David Brooks, who's giving a talk called Humility in the Time of Me. It's a brilliant talk to help challenge us in a very individualistic age to consider, what does it mean as Christians to actually think well about pride and the way it's starting to get out of control? What does it mean as we look towards the future of how it's shifting the world and how we can be a part of the solution? Let's continue to listen in now.
So in global comparisons, the U.S. is among the leaders of the world in self-esteem. Most egotistical countries are Serbia, Chile, Israel, and the U.S. And so this has been a shift. And it's produced some good cultures. We're expansive. People believe in themselves. Steve Jobs believed in himself. But it's also created some of our problems. First, changes attitudes about consumption. If you think you're pretty special, and you want to show how special you are by what you wear and what you own, you're going to consume more. Personal consumption as a share of GDP is 60% decade after decade through the 20th century. Starting in 1970, it jumps up to 70%. Personal debt as a percent of GDP, 43% decade after decade, it jumps up to 133%. So consumption changes. Public debt. Every generation has an incentive to push costs on the future generation and enjoy the benefits for themselves. But no generation until our own has really done that because they had a moral horror about pushing debt on their children and grandchildren. And I think that's because they saw themselves as a small piece of a large chain. But if you see yourself isolated from the large chain, you're much more likely to do that. Third, risk. People who are confident think they can handle risk. Take bigger loans, make bigger bets on Wall Street. See the results. Fourth, polarization. If you're modest and have an awareness of the limits of your own knowledge, you know that you need the people who disagree with you to correct for your own errors. If you think you have the truth 100%, then the people who disagree with you are just in the way. And so we see a rise of polarization. Moral inarticulateness. We have trained a generation of people to think for themselves, to come up with their own moral values. If your name is Aristotle, fine, you can do it. If your name is not Aristotle, you probably can't. And so we've raised a generation of people who are good, but who are often inarticulate about morality. Christian Smith, a scholar at Notre Dame, did a study where he looked over college students and he asked them to name a moral dilemma. I think it was something like two-thirds could not name a moral dilemma. They said, well, I pull into a parking space, I don't have enough quarters. That's a problem, it's not a moral dilemma. And so he said they have good instincts, but they do not have the vocabulary to describe their moral tensions or to have moral debate. So it devolves into whatever feels good for you must be right. And that's because we've told people to discover their own morality. So in part because of this shift in culture, the promise of the meritocracy have not been fulfilled. We have a fairer, better society than they did in the 1940s, but our faith in institutions, and I think the performance institutions, is down. And so this is the problem. And frankly, what I've just described to you is chapter one of my next book. And I haven't really thought much about the others. I'm stumbling my way, but what can help? Well, a lot of things can help in moral revival. The first is exemplars, praising the values of modesty and humility and remembering what they are. People like Francis Perkins, people like George C. Marshall, people celebrated by the writer Jim Collins, the business writer in Good to Great, who said the people who he studies combine extreme personal humility with extreme personal willpower. They're not the grand visionaries that are on the magazines. They are completely organized. They're paranoid. They know how little they know, and they just do the same damn thing one time after another. C.S. Lewis wrote, "Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you he is a nobody. Probably all that you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. He will not be thinking of humility. He will not be thinking of himself at all." And so that's one set of exemplars. The second, philosophy. There is a school of what you might call the crooked school of humanity, school of philosophy. Rediscovering that, Augustine, Edmund Burke, Isaiah Berlin, Reinhold Niebuhr. People who built their knowledge on the awareness of how little we can know and built a model for doing things with knowing that our sin is warped in. Niebuhr said that all sin is really just an excess of good, that when you think you're doing the best, that's when you're in trouble. The third is manners. We're in Washington. We now have a model for what public spiritedness is. It should be said that when the founders started this country, their model was completely different than our model. Now we think being public spirited is signing petitions, voting, making your voice heard. When George Washington was here, public spirited meant suppressing your passions, suppressing your extremism in order to help the common good. And that's why Washington was so reticent, rediscovering those manners. And finally, discovering a proper viewpoint. I read a lot of commencement speeches, a very dreary art form. And if you think they're dreary, you should see when I give them. But the central message is find your passion. College students told to find your passion. March to the beat of your own drummer. Be who you are. The message is you, you, you. Well, during command performances, there's a man who has just been released from a concentration camp named Viktor Frankl, who wrote a huge book in the 1950s called Man's Search for Meaning. And Frankl had a different viewpoint, which was not find your passion. Frankl grew up in Austria and wanted to lead a certain sort of life. He was thrown into a concentration camp, and he said, hey, this was not the life I would have chosen, but this is what life put in front of me. And he became a scholar of suffering, because that's what was put in front of him. And he wrote that suffering became a problem upon which I didn't want to turn my back. And so his response was, it's not what you're questioning life that matters, it's what life is questioning you. It's what putting in front of your path. And it's not what do I want from life, but what does life want from me? It's not what's the purpose of my life, it's what is the purpose that's been assigned. And the purpose is not to find yourself, it's to lose yourself. And that's an entirely different ethos. And so I don't know entirely about where this is going to lead me, but I do think there are models around of how to live life in an effective way, but with that culture of self-effacement. Thank you.
Well, you've just listened to one of my favorite Q Talks. So I hope it's challenged you. And I want to encourage you, if this line of thinking and the way this has challenged you today, you want to go deeper, The book Road to Character by David Brooks really explores this. And you know, in a time where our 20-somethings and our culture has so influenced the way younger people are thinking about this, I've talked to so many who've said David Brooks, this particular talk, his book The Road to Character, his conversations around really thinking about wisdom that comes over many, many years and trials and learning and life versus sort of the immediacy of the moment has really helped them be grounded when they've seen around them a lot of friends who are constantly feeling anxiety about what they're going to accomplish and who they're becoming and the challenge of our age, to really set back and to trust that God's at work in our lives and we can be patient. In addition to that, David Brooks is actually going to be one of our featured presenters at Q Commons October 26th. So if you're interested in bringing David Brooks to your community via our Q Commons broadcast, where we combine national talks with local talks, go to qcommons.com and learn more. Well, it's been great being with you. We'll continue the learning together over the next week. Go to qideas.org where you can also watch this talk on video. And I hope you have a wonderful week. This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.